from the creators who brought you RuPaul's Drag Race and Million Dollar Listing. This is World of Wonders Wow Report. Things that make us go wow.
Hello and welcome everyone to another edition of the Wow Report, where we count down the top 10 things of the week that make us go wow. I'm Fenton Bailey, co-founder of World of Wonder, joined by Tom Campbell, our chief creative officer, and literary legend James St. James.
How do you do?
Good. This is a fun top 10, I have to say. Let's jump in at number 10.
Number 10.
This show makes me feel so good after I'm done, but I start a little grumpy. So my number 10 is it got a lot of grumpy in it. And I want to bitch about three couples. Actually, bitch about two and praise one. One couple is the Golden Bachelor and his wife.
Oh, I'm right with you.
I refuse to learn their names. I watched previews. I did not watch the show. I know it was a sensation. I can't deny its power in the popular culture and how, I guess, it's cosplay. It's like, you know, war reenactments of dating and romance. It's just fake.
Yes.
And the idea that the Golden Bachelor, that two, and this again probably speaks more about me, but that two old people love them, are going to fall in love on a show that's that's all manufactured, and they all speak this crazy love language. This doesn't exist in real life. And then they get married.
They really want you to believe that they're falling in love.
Yes.
And it's ruined. That this is the best thing that's ever happened to them.
Just so cynical. The whole exercise of it is cynical. The wedding was cynical. And then even their announcement on Good Morning America, which they spun off into a nightline, you know, it's just the way that the morning shows need ratings and glom onto the Bachelor. It's just yuckity, yuck, yuck, yuck. Okay, next couple in the yuckity yuck, Tom being a grump. Did you hear about Meghan Markle and Prince Harry and their new shows?
I just so can wait not to see these shows.
Meghan Markle is going to curate.
No. I'm not going to jump on the anti-Harry and Meghan.
I am. You don't have to. Let me, and then you can shame me. I don't get their brand. I don't get who they are. The smartest thing she should have done was go on to the Golden Globes with the rest of the cast of Suits. You know, like, normalize yourself. Put yourself among real humans. Because she is going to, according to some kind of press release around Netflix, where they had that big deal, is that she's going to curate a show, which sounds like she's not going to be on very much, that echoes her love of gardening and food and entertaining.
Now, no. I'm not going to bash Meghan and Harry. Harry did the right thing by getting his wife and family out of that toxic.
Okay, and since that time, they have made a series of blunders. From a brand point of view,
they have to raise a family. They have to make money. What are they going to do?
So poor. The struggling blue collar storyline continues because Prince Harry is going to do a docu series about polo.
Well, what else does he know, for Christ's sakes? He's a prince. Of course he's going to do polo. Of course he's going to garden. You aren't mad at Oprah for gardening. You aren't mad at Martha Stewart for gardening.
She earned her right to garden.
She definitely earned her. She had to put up with that bitch, Kate.
She is on gardening leave. Let's just say that. She's on gardening leave. And she's decided to launch her own brand, American Riviera Orchard.
What?
And she sent out 50 jars of bespoke jam.
I would like some bespoke jam from Meghan Markle.
You weren't on the list. So.
Guys, this is a Freaky Friday because I think James and I woke up in different each other's bodies.
I don't understand. I don't understand. Why would you hate on the Duke and Duchess of...
I find them yuckity yuck yuck yuck. Last, Mark Consuelos celebrated his 1-year anniversary co-hosting Kelly and Mark.
And you happy with that?
I love that show. I love them. They're beautiful to look at. We knew them. They're proven in a way. But day in and day out, we were going to listen to them talk about their happy marriage. And yes, we are. They are delightful. They have like that little quiz show they do at the beginning where they talk to us, they give away trips and things, has turned into this thing called
Can I Stump
Mark? Stump Mark. Yeah. And Mark gets so competitive because they tell a truth and a lie. And within like 1 minute, he gets to question them and decide if they told the truth or a lie. And his average is more that he can break them down. And if he wins, they don't win the t-shirt or the mug, but they go on for the trip anyway. And Kelly has never seemed happier. You know, she's in the Time Magazine 100 Most Influential People. Anderson Cooper in the Time Magazine wrote about her and said she would never admit it, but she's one of the top broadcasters in television history, which she's been doing it for 25 years, kind of appearingly effortlessly, but working very hard. And they seem happy together. And they're empty nesters, so it's kind of like this new hope for people. Forget about the Golden Bachelor. Stay with the person you're with. And then get your own national talk show when the kids move out of the house.
The key is, I think, in TV hosting, to never give up. Like, Oprah should have just carried on. Like, you grow to love these people. And by doing the same thing day after day after day, hopefully, they get better at it. Like, I'm still hoping. Like
David Letterman is at the top of his game.
Right, exactly.
Or they can do the Jon Stewart thing where you just go on Monday. You just show up on Monday and then leave it to everybody else.
Don't get me started on Jon Stewart.
All right, well, let's move on. We had three sort of not so happy couples. I think there's a thematic thing that's going to emerge here today. Number nine.
I watched Brandy Helville, The Cult of Fast Fashion on Max. I don't know if you guys have watched this, if you know about it.
What is it?
I watched it. Brandy Helville. It's a searing documentary tell-all expose about the clothing brand Brandy Melville.
It kind of reminded me of like the last year's documentary about Abercrombie and Fitch.
Sort of. What Brandy Melville has supplanted Abercrombie and Fitch as the go-to brand for teenage girls around the country. Everyone wants to be a Brandy Melville girl.
I guess I'm not a teenage girl. I've never heard of the brand. Never, ever, ever.
You're wearing one of her blouses.
Okay. I've always seen it at the Grove and like the Americana, but I never knew what it was.
I have so much to unpack here because Brandy Melville is a juggernaut company that has captured teenage girls in a way that nobody else has. What they're famous for is their snotty attitude, right? When you walk in the store, they do not pay attention to you. They shun you if you do not look a certain way. You have to have a California girl look about you, a Malibu 1970s boho waif look. The most famous thing about them is they do not have sizes. Their clothes are one size fits most, is what it says. And by most, it means teenage waifs of a certain size. And there are thousands and tens of thousands of videos on YouTube of girls getting their Brandy Melville outfits and trying them on for the camera and finding out that they do not
fit. And it's huge on Instagram, right?
It's huge on Instagram.
Like their Instagram is all curated. Like,
and if you walk into the store and if you have the Brandy Melville look, they will take your picture and put you on their Instagram, and there is no higher honor for a teenage girl. Now, the takeaway from all of this and what I've buried the lead here is that my niece, Caroline, works at the Brandy Melville here in Hollywood at the Grove, okay? And suddenly, watching this documentary, everything about my niece suddenly makes sense. My niece looks like a sickly, anemic Victorian waif, okay, who is about...
She's not listening. I just...
I'm sorry, Caroline, but I talked to her about this after I watched the documentary. And she's so bored of everything. Uncle Jimmy, you have said it's so boring. It is so stupid. Everything is boring. Everything is, and she has this hair, this long hair that's always in her face and blowing in the wind. Like, even when there's no wind, her hair is like blowing in the wind. And she's always wearing these little baby tees that look like she got from, like, you know, Goodwill bin for children, infants.
So and far, she sounds fabulous. Continue.
She is fabulous. She is more fabulous than I will ever be. But apparently, at age 24, they call her the old hag at the store. They say, here comes the old hag, because she's 24 years old and working at Brandy.
Oh, well, it's like you back in the 90s at the club.
Well, it's true. When I was 25, and they called me granny at the rave. It's the cycles of generations, the trauma, the cascading trauma of generations. But anyway, so this documentary is about...
Who's behind it?
Well, it's this horrible pervert from Italy who is behind it, who just hires these, 18-year-old waif girls. It's very... And everybody is, like, hidden and telling the story, blah, blah, blah. And how they don't allow people of a certain body size, there's no black people working there. There's no Latinos working there. It's all white wasp girls who get to work at Brandy Melville.
Well, and then the girls of color who did work there were all in the basement.
Yeah, they could only do the stocking in the basement, but they were
In the Abercrombie dog.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is there no Brandy Melville?
There is no Brandy Melville. Oh, okay. It's not a person. It's an ideal. It's a lifestyle ideal that you try and get to. But my niece Caroline says that the Hollywood store is not like that anymore, and that there's a couple girls of color and people of different sizes and stuff. But the fact of the matter is they can't wear the Brandy Melville clothes because it's one size fits most, which doesn't fit anyone.
And is that all that the documentary is that's what the documentary is about?
And fast fashion like Zara, H&M is clogging up the oceans because an outfit a day is what they put out there. And then if it doesn't sell, it goes to Africa. It goes to this one.
Ghana?
Yeah, Ghana, I think.
But it all ends up on the beaches. Like this one group was like, we've dug down 6 feet and we're still on clothes. They're not even the sand yet, so it's like crazy.
And they just have like these cargo ships of containers full of Zara fashion and Temu and Shine and all that stuff that doesn't sell, that ends up in these landfills on the beaches and then it's a terrible situation.
That's not just Brandy Melville, then it's
fun. No, it isn't. No, it's the cult of fast fashion that is exemplified by the Brandy Melville. It's a fascinating documentary, and it's worth seeing. And I just had to have that personal. I had that personal connection to it. That is just suddenly everything came glaring into this.
Your niece would ever join us here on the WOW Report?
Well, I was gonna ask her, but it's Uncle Jimmy already.
But she's gonna be unemployed pretty soon if her bosses see this. They're probably like gonna fire her.
I think the next time James is traveling or something, he can't join us, we get his niece.
All right. Okay.
So
that's Brandy Melville documentary on Max. All right, number 8. Okay, gonna cheer things up.
Number 8.
This week, Monday, April the 15th, was the 112th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic.
Too soon. Too soon, Fenton. Too soon.
Well, yeah, going to lighten things up a bit. Are you?
I was being a little, facetious or ironic or whatever. So it's a fantastic documentary. I've talked about this series before, a little bit before. The rest is history. They've just done a 6-hour podcast about it, and it is fantastic. It's hosted by Dominic Sandbrook, Tom Holland, and I have to say, the Titanic is one of those evergreen subjects. I don't believe there will ever come a time when we're not fascinated by the Titanic.
What did you learn?
I learned a few things, and I'll share just a few things. One is that Bruce Ismay, who was the sort of mastermind behind the Titanic, and who during his life was the man who had crossed the Atlantic the most number of times, he has been universally reviled as a villain since the Titanic sank. He was supposedly the man who said, go faster. He was supposedly the guy who survived. Well, he did survive the Titanic. But, the idea that being that women and children were thrust aside as he pushed his way onto a lifeboat. None of these things is true. The Titanic was not even going at full speed. He did not ask the boat to go any faster. And he didn't even want to get on a lifeboat when the opportunity arose. The problem was they were putting the lifeboats in and there were empty seats. There was just no one to get on the lifeboats, even though, yes, they had far insufficient number of lifeboats for all the passengers. The problem was they were being lowered into the water and the passengers were all elsewhere. It was an empty seat. Get on it or don't. But it's not that he was a coward. And in fact, the rest of his life was so awful. And, you know, talk about survivor's guilt and just plunged into a depression. One of the other things I learned is that actually a lot of survivors, people who survived, did in fact kill themselves out of guilt and just depression. And so it's not just the people who died on the Titanic. More interesting things. The sea at the time was completely flat and completely still. And had there been some sort of swell, it would have been easier to spot the iceberg because of the reflections. But the fact that it was just like glass, the iceberg was sort of invisible. Number three, the wisdom at the time, if you were going to hit an iceberg, just go for it. Hit it straight on. Do not try to go to the side. Because when you go to the side, most of the iceberg is underwater and it acts like a knife and just slits the boat open, which, of course, is what happened to the unsinkable Titanic. This one is really good. They had this fancy new radio telegraph system invented by Marconi on board, and everybody was sending Marconigrams. They were sort of the equivalent in the back in the day of selfies or Instagram or tweets or texts. The only problem with that was there were so many being sent that the radio operators were completely overwhelmed, so that the incoming warnings that there was ice in the water and to watch out went unheeded. Here's one that really got me and actually made me actually kind of cry. The Goldsmiths family emigrating from the UK. By the way, even though we think of the Titanic as the last word in luxury, which it was at the time, its main purpose was as an immigrant ship to carry people to America. That was how the Titanic was going to make its money and be a success. Anyway, Goldsmith's family emigrating from the UK to the US, they had a family friend in the US, and they said, oh, can you bring our son? He's 15 and be nice, you know, if he could travel with you. So, of course, he does. He's 15 years old. On the night before the Titanic sinks, he celebrates his 16th birthday. And he is given, to celebrate that, a pair of long trousers.
Oh.
The significance of that is that in the day, back in the day, when you were a child, before you reached adulthood, you always and only ever wore shorts. I remember myself at school, only wore shorts. And when you got your first pair of long trousers, it was like, yes,
You were an Edwardian child, weren't you?
I am a man. Yes. But the tragedy is, and this is what gets me, is that he was wearing his long trousers. And as a result, as they were boarding women and children in the lifeboats, he was not put on a lifeboat because he was in long trousers. So he wasn't a child. And so he perished. Isn't that just the worst? That's like, and I guess that's one example that makes you realize every single life of the more than 1,500 people who died and then the people who survived and what they lived with and the families. It's just something that just sort of, even though it's hundreds of years ago or 112 years, it still is a very present thing.
That's a lot of information packed in there and very interesting and very moving.
Thank you. And that's just some of it. And the last thing, I know we have to go to a break. The last thing I'll tell you, and this is kind of funny, is that, you know, in America, there was a hearing and it was all about capitalism and sort of greed and all the sort of moral story about the folly and the hubris of the Titanic. In Britain, the story played as one of heroic failure. The idea that it was almost celebrated, the fact that men stood by and quietly went to their deaths. And the podcasters make this point that there is something peculiar about the British Empire and its mental state is that enduring disaster in a dignified way is almost something to celebrate. And what a weird kind of complex, where does that come from? What is it?
And nothing exemplifies that more than, you know, during World War One and then later World War Two, the keep calm, carry on during the bombing of the Blitz and all of that.
Exactly.
It is that same mentality of we must endure. We must keep a stiff upper lip as we go to our doom.
The podcasters think it's kind of like a guilt complex for the Empire, of all the sort of cruelties and exploitation that the British Empire visited on people. It's like, well, when it goes shit shape, when the ship goes down, you have to, this is your comeuppance.
Man up. Yes, this is your comeuppance.
Yeah. But it is man against nature, and nature won, you know. And it's like, right. And so you're left there on your man-made hubris, you know, sinking slowly into the sea.
Let's take a break. Tom, will you do the promo? Because tonight is a special night.
Oh my God. It is the grand finale of RuPaul's Drag Race season 16. And, you know, we love the show. There's never been a bad season. This may be one of the best, most well-received. I think it's the highest rated season, or it's going to be at the end of the day.
I'm having more fun this season than I've had in years. I love it.
And just, we're off last week where we instead of having a reunion where people like just rehashed old Twitter feuds, we had a lip sync SmackDown for the queen if she already had hers. So all the returning queens got to do a lip sync SmackDown. And it was so entertaining and so fulfilling. And you just realized what a cast from the first eliminated to our top three, what stars they all are. And I think we're going to see a lot more of them all. But tonight we crown ourselves a winner, whether it's going to be a Nymphia Wind, whether it's going to be Plain Jane, or whether it's going to be Sophia Kristal, all worthy in their own way. So,
and that, of course, is on MTV 9 p.m. ET, or if you're out of the country, you can watch it on Wow Presents Plus at wowpresentsplus.com. And if you miss it, or even if you don't, come down to DragCon LA July 19th and 20th and meet many of the queens from season 16.
Yeah. And James and James.
Of course. Jimmy
said, I'll be there. Right. Yeah. My grand return after 5 years.
Will your niece be there with you as well?
She will, actually. She
now I'm going.
No books, yes.
You're listening to World of Wonders Wow Report. Things that make us go wow.
Welcome back to the Wow Report. I'm Fenton here with Tom and James and Blake. All right, we're counting down the top 10 things of the week that made us go wow. And we've reached number 7.
Number 7.
This is a film, a documentary that I watched this week, not for the first time, but I have to say maybe in its entirety for the second time. And I want to talk about it because I have a whole new perspective. And it's the legendary documentary, the documentary of all documentaries, Grey Gardens.
Oh.
When's the last time you think you've seen Grey Gardens, the documentary?
Well, interestingly, I watched it about a month ago.
Well, there you go.
I've never seen it.
What?
But has it been a while, or can you remember?
It has been a while. It's been at least 5 or maybe 10 years.
Well, wait a minute. Blake, will you watch it? Is it something you want to see? Yes. Yeah. Okay. Because I, you know, I'm a fan. I love the musical. I think the musical was fantastic. And I loved the Drew Barrymore. And
I love the musical. I love the HBO thing of Drew Barrymore and Jessica Lange. Right? But, and it's been, you know, and Jinx Monsoon played Little Edie on, you know, so it's such a touchstone for us.
I did see that.
Okay, good. But the actual documentary is so unique, has such quality, and it's everything, but it's really those two. They are such incredible storytellers. They are so stimulated by the camera being on them. They are so captivating. They are beautiful. They are insane. They live in squalor. But I think when I was younger, I felt like I was looking down on them or how sad their life turned out. And now I look at it and think, but for the grace of God, go I. Like, this is
what actual glorious, gorgeous, fabulous people they were.
Yes!
Like, you staunch characters. You don't make them like that anymore.
And, you know, I can't believe anyone doesn't know, but this is Jacqueline Kennedy's aunt and cousin, and Lee Raswell as well, who in the 70s lived in a tony part of the Hamptons, but
they can get people wearing blue stockings on Tuesday.
Exactly. But they had, you know, the father had divorced the mother. The Edie had sort of lived with her mother for 25 years, kind of captured there, but they were, and they had no money. And so the water was turned off and you know,
raccoons had moved in.
Yes, and cats everywhere. So it was, they were this living in this incredible rich family, the cousin of the first lady in the United States, living in absolute squalor.
Is a Tony part of the Hamptons a good part or the bad part?
No, Tony means fabulous. Means very chic. Rock.
And I was reminded of a character who I know, but Jerry in the musical. Jerry loved my corn, and Jerry came to them the first day, and one of them called him the Mobile Fawn, you know, referring to some like, you know, incredibly storied mythological thing. And he was this cute kind of Long Island guy who did errands for them.
Ass hippie is what he is, but just beautiful in a way of the Joe Dell side. He could have been a Warhol superstar. Yeah.
And those kind of summer jobs that you remember having in the 70s, or just helping people, or jumping over the fence, or I could fix that. Or like, I'm making some corn next to my bed. Would you like some? Sure. We'll have some corn.
In your hot plate full of corn.
By the way, eating in bed. Ding, ding, ding. Cat taking over my apartment. Ding, ding, ding. Soon I'll be wearing shower curtains because I'm going to have to wrap them around my waist. But I loved it. I loved them. While there is pathos in it, and maybe the pathos was hard for me to watch as a young person, as a, you know, life takes a toll on you. Life turns out the way it turns out. And they were magnificent in their own, I don't want to say squalor, but in their own unique circumstances. And I just, it's a marvelous documentary.
That after working with kooky drag queens for the last 15 years, and I think America has met so many kooky characters over the last couple of years through reality television, that now we can see them. We can see them for the beauty that they are in a way that maybe in the 70s and 80s when they first came out, you couldn't.
Rebels that they were, you know, they were really against the norm.
Revolutionary outfit for today. Yes, the revolutionary costume for today.
And last thing, Jerry, the hunky guy. So I looked him up immediately because I'm like, where's Jerry today? He's still alive. The Maisel brothers who directed and produced this, they found him like in a taxi cab, like 10 years ago, like they were looking for all this time. And they did another documentary, which I haven't found yet, but about him. And he's a sculptor. He's gay. He is a long-term partner. And so just I didn't know that little piece of continued history from
Well, Tom, have you seen that one summer that it's sort of the Lee Radzwell and Peter Beard?
Lee Radzwell commissioned and her husband at the time commissioned a documentary with the Maisel brothers, and they started doing it, and then they lost the film, which sounds suspect, but they found the film all these years later and turned it into this documentary, which I haven't seen, which is that
yeah,
one summer.
You'll have to, because it sort of continues the story. It tells the story from Lee's point of view of going to the house and everything.
Oh, that's right. Of trying to sort of sort them out a bit, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So if you're like a Blake and you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. If you're like the rest of us and it's such a big part of your thing, but it becomes myth, see it again, see the detail because it's so rich and delightful.
That's marvelous. That's Grey Gardens streaming on Max. All right, moving on. James, number six.
Number six.
I got my copy of Candy Darling, Dreamer, Icon, Superstar by Cynthia Carr, who did David Voinarovich.
And in that tradition of just reading the headline, Tom, and not wondering, I thought, I'll send this book to James St. James. He will read it and talk about it on the WoW Reports.
Well done.
Yes, and we did talk about it. We talked about it when it was announced that it came out, but I've started reading it, and I have some thoughts. It's a doorstop of a book. I mean, it's just huge, huge, huge. It's every day of her life, basically, we learn about. It's an exhaustive document of her life. The problem I have with it early on, because she hasn't gotten to New York and become Candy yet, is that this 2024 need to be gender knowledgeable and gender correct about everything is getting in the way of the narrative, because you have these paragraphs where you have people referring to Candy and Jimmy and he and him and she and her, and Cynthia, the author, doesn't pick a lane. So you have all of it in one paragraph where it's like, suddenly it's like reading the Brothers Karamazov or something, where somebody has like 20 different names. They're referring to Jimmy and Candy and he and him and her and she in the same paragraph. And you don't really, you're like, you have whiplash. Who are we talking? You know, like, you just wish that they would say candy all along.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's a little confusing, but I have a feeling that will resolve once Candy gets to New York and gets to the factory and all of that really starts to take off. It has been announced, I don't know if we talked about this before, but that there's a movie that John Cameron Mitchell is producing the movie. Zachary Drucker, our good friend, is directing it. And Hari Neff, the fabulous, fabulous trans icon, gorgeous actress, Hari Neff is playing Candy.
Oh, wow, so what a dream role.
Could you be in better hands than to have those three people doing it? So I'm very much looking forward to that.
That is Candy Darling by Cynthia Carr, out now. Number five. Another book, a hot read that I actually have not yet read, but have every intention of reading. I just discovered it literally today, in fact. Earl Spencer. Remember when Princess Di, the funeral of Princess Di, Westminster Abbey?
Hey, Earl Spencer.
And he was devastating.
Devastating, scorching.
Through the heart of the British establishment. And
her brother, right? Her brother.
He salted the earth.
He did. And he lives, of course, in Althorpe Estate, which is a sort of Saltburnian, vast, gorgeous, capability brown, Palladian mansions. Yeah, what have antiques, deer parks, the lot.
He outroils the royals.
There you go. So Princess Diana's brother has written a book. He's written several books as a historian, actually, quite a reputable historian, let's say. But he's written a book called A Very Private School. And it tells about his life being sent away to boarding school at the age of 8. And just jaw-dropping. I immediately ordered it, so I have to yet read it. But this school that he was sent to basically was, one review describes it as an upper-class prison camp staffed by bullying pedophiles, which actually sounds something of an understatement. The headmaster there was sort of basically a professional sadist who beat the boys on a regular basis.
Isn't this every single boarding school in
well,
England?
It is, but I guess he's in his early 60s. He went to this boarding school in the early 70s, Maidwell Hall. And you're right, James, it is the story of every boarding school. But I mean, to some extent, it was my own experience, actually.
I was going to say, I hear, you know,
resounding. When did you go to boarding school? How old were you, Fenton?
I was 8. I went to, what was it called? West Hill Park was called. And then when I was 12, I went to a boarding school called Bradfield. And
there was lots of boyish night pounding and all of that.
Yeah. We had a Greek theater and we did plays in ancient Greek, as you do, you know, and we had to wear gowns, you know, black academic gowns, which actually was quite good for swishing around. But it was a pretty brutal experience. And it just goes back to this sort of Titanic thing of this sort of British stiff upper lip and this sort of almost this idea of institutionalized torture as a terribly good thing and the making of you. And it's amazing that he's actually written this book. I mean, he says he's written it not to encourage any particular sympathy, but just for his own sort of cathartic peace of mind. But it is an extraordinary phenomena that, you know, the British upper, the height of privilege was to be able to send your kid to a public school, which is a private school, which is a boarding school. So everybody was in on it. It wasn't just the super rich. My parents were sort of middle class, but their aspiration was to be able to send us to a boarding school. And we wanted to go to them because we thought that was the best thing. Of course, I mean, and then as a result of it, because of it being such a complete fucking nightmare, there's a sort of omerta that you don't want to, you know, if you start complaining about it, you're complaining to your parents who are giving up so much.
Right.
You're being a whinger. You're not being that person who's standing on the deck of the Titanic as it's sinking.
Can I ask you a dumb question? Do these schools still exist? To what extent are they different? Do you know?
They absolutely do still exist. And they all say, Maidwell Hall made a statement after Earl Spencer's book was published saying, you know, we're very sorry. But the school has changed beyond recognition since then. And I guess 9 times out of 10, that's very possibly true. Most of them, for example, are co-ed, which perhaps is can only be a good thing, I guess, unless you're like me and you're just an inveterate gay, in which case it doesn't make any difference. But I do think the luster of this educational system has sort of gone, and that these institutions have proven to be historically a sort of haven for some pretty twisted individuals. I tell you, my divinity master at prep school, when I was eight, and went willingly, by the way, I wasn't sent away, you know, but he had a sort of a wig, basically a toupee that had an absurd bump that like a pharaonic hat. And he was sort of ramrod straight in terms of his demeanor, but gay as a goose and a complete sadist. I mean, in addition to midnight naked swims, he would also take exercise books that were stapled together. And if you got the answers wrong, he'd unpick the staples and then slap you across the face so that you had scratches across. I mean, all this stuff was sanctioned and no one like...
And you were like, not my face, not my face.
But anyway, I'm really excited to read this book. Let's take one more break. RuPaul's Drag Race Live Untucked, coming this Wednesday to WOW Presents Plus, captures what really happens behind the curtain of the hottest show in the Las Vegas Strip, RuPaul's Drag Race Live, of course.
I want to tip my hat to Michael Pressman, who refuses to come on our show, who runs digital, because between House of Laughs, which just came out, and this show, their amazing programming, bravo. I know it's not more than just Michael involved, but I want to give a shout out to Michael.
And our fearless leader is amazing. Absolutely right. And Pete Williams and a whole bunch of great people. So, yes. WowPresentsPlus.com.
You're listening to World of Wonders WOW Report. That make us go wow.
All right, we're counting down the top 10 things of the week that made us go wow. We've reached number four, Tom.
Number four.
Sunday morning started off as it always does. My Alexa goes off at 7. I say, Alexa off. Alexa, turn on NPR, where I listen to the NPR morning show religiously as I get ready for something I go out and do in the morning. And the incredible hosts, Aisha Roscoe, who I love, 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 love. She's been on for at least a year, probably more. She just is a ray of sunshine. She actually has a personality and a voice that isn't an NPR voice. She's just saying, anyway, she runs the hour at about 7:45, which I have to be someplace at 8, so I'm always playing. There is the Puzzle Master. Will Shorts usually comes on, and they have this fun puzzle I like to play along with. And she says, I've been listening to it the last few weeks, and there's been somebody filling in for Will, and I didn't think much about it, or I was running late or whatever. And she said, I'm so happy in her to have Will Shorts back. And I didn't know he'd been gone for a reason. I found out in that moment he had a stroke on February 3rd. And it had been in the hospital and was just released from the hospital. So I had this huge burge. I'm terrible. But I'm like, oh my God, he had a, and then, oh my God, he's back. And then when he spoke, he was clear, but the left side of his body that he's still going through treatment for has been totally affected. So you can hear it in his speech. And it just was this 360 of emotion, because it was like, oh, my favorite show's on with my favorite people and Will's back. Yay. And she's so excited because he's back from his, you know, his stroke bed. And it's like, oh my God. And he's been the editor of the New York Times Crossword Puzzle since 1993. He was the Puzzle Master at NPR since 89. He is the cutest guy. He's gay. He's got a partner. I just have been taking him for granted because he's everywhere in my life.
Well, when you say Puzzle Master, what does he do? Like, is it like, what is the Puzzle Master?
He creates the crossword puzzle for the New York Times and other games. And he is a savant. As a child, you know, he was doing puzzles. He was just into it from like 8, 9, 10. He went to the Indiana University and he created his own major in, I don't know, gameology. It's called something else.
Puzzling.
Puzzling. But I'm just here to celebrate Will Shorts, who makes the most fun puzzles, who's the nicest, most kind. You just, you know, it's like someone who's been on my, in my ear for 2 decades, and I just take for granted that he's there. And I might, between New York Times, NPR, whatever, I have a lot of fun doing that. And he's getting better, and I wish him so much. And I realize he's 72. I'm 60 wonderful, as you remember. But you know, it's happening, people. It's happening. Not to say he can't live a lot longer, but God bless us all, and thank you, Will Shorts, for all the joy you bring me and so many others, and and speedy recovery.
Congratulations, Will Shorts, on remaining in place.
In place.
Yes. James, number three.
Number three.
Did you guys get a chance to see Ryan Gosling on Saturday Night Live last week?
I saw a few clips he's cute as pie and funny, but he laughed the entire time.
He cracked himself up as he does, because he is just so damn adorable. It was a slam dunk of an episode. It was so good. It was their least political episode in years. And you got to think that Ryan Gosling right now can do no wrong. You know, after Barbie, after that incredible, instantly iconic Oscar I'm Just Ken performance, it with the Fall Guy getting this unprecedented amount of buzz that it's just going to be the best movie of the year. You've got to think that if you're his publicist, you're getting a bonus right now,
if you're his biggest fan, like James St. James is, you're living pretty high.
How could you not be his fan though?
But you're his number one fan.
He's such a likable guy. He's so charismatic. And he did this opening sketch. He did the those three alien abductees with Kate McKinnon. She came back to do it, where two of them have this wonderful experience, and then Kate McKinnon is like butt fucked, like, you know, three ways from Sunday. And he cracked up during that. At one point, like, she's sort of like going up his pants, and it was just dirty, filthy, filthy fun. And he loved it. But then the Beavis and Butthead sketch, which people are saying is the best sketch they've done in 20 years, where he and Mikey Day just happened to look like Beavis and Butthead.
Someone was testifying, and behind the woman who they're talking to, you know, those extras, like, you know, there are people in the courtroom and whatever. And one of them looks just like Beavis, and one of them looks just like, but it's like, what, me? I look just like, and they had done grotesque things, you know, prosthetics and things to make them grotesquely look like Beavis and Butthead. And whenever the woman, I forget her name, whenever she turned around, she's like, what are you talking about? And she was, you've got the idea that
she hadn't seen it, obviously. They hadn't rehearsed it. So that it was her first reaction when she saw it. And she dissolves into peals of laughter. And sometimes, you know, you get a little irritated, like when Jimmy Fallon used to giggle his way through it. But this, for some reason, this was so genuine and so unforced.
It was a contagious case of the giggles the entire hour. Hour and a half.
I don't know. I mean, Fenton, are you not as enamored with Ryan Gosling as
I am enamored? No, I'm totally
the best that we have, because, you know, he does drama, he does comedy.
I'm here for it. Yeah,
he does song and dance. He seems
unaffected by it all. He seems like a genuinely nice guy.
Goofball. For someone as gorgeous as he is, he doesn't take life seriously. He doesn't take himself seriously. He's just a lovable goof, is what he is.
Oh, I love it. Well, congratulations, Ryan Gosling. I'm going to lighten the mood. Number two.
Number two.
My old next door neighbor, when he used to live up on Sycamore, has written a book, and it is called Nuclear War, A Scenario. It is storming the New York Times bestseller charts. I think it's going
to
maybe displace House of Hidden Meanings. It has dropped like a bomb, eliminating the competition. Anyway, okay, I'll stop with that.
Is it mushrooming through the counter?
Exactly. There you go. It is exactly what it says. It is an imagining of what would happen if there was a nuclear war, which in some respects, I guess, isn't that original an idea. But the way Annie does this, she estimates that it would take 72 minutes to end the world. And she's written this 373-page book that takes you through second by second. I haven't read the whole thing yet, but she did write a piece in the Daily Mail.
Spoiler.
I know, just for a change. She writes in the Daily Mail, in the first fraction of a millisecond after the bomb strikes the Pentagon, there is light, soft, silvery X-ray light with a very short wavelength. The light superheats the surrounding air to millions of degrees, creating a massive fireball that expands at millions of miles per hour. Within a few seconds, the fireball is more than a mile. Heat so intense that concrete explodes, metal melts, stone shatters, and people instantaneously convert into combusting carbon. The Pentagon explodes into superheated dust. People are transformed into charred human figurines, into soot. Within seconds, the thermal radiation has deeply burned the skin on roughly 1 million people, 90% of whom will die. The intense heat generated by this creates a high-pressure wave that moves out a giant wall of highly compressed air traveling faster than the speed of sound. Next comes the deadly reverse suction effect. Objects, cars, people, street signs, parking meters, sucked back into the center of the burning inferno and consumed by... That is just within the first 60 seconds. And
then there's the radiation and the fallout, the disfigurement and all that good stuff.
Khrushchev said that the living would envy the dead. And that, of course, the U.S., you know, the policy in a nuclear strike situation is to launch on warning, which means you don't wait for the missiles to hit you before you fire back. I mean,
I'm so glad I know this secret to surviving. Duck and cover.
Right.
Yes, crawl under your desk and put your hands over your head. Yeah.
Well, exactly. And I think that stands for the fact that no one really knows what would happen in terms of, you know, the collapse of society, panic. I mean, she has written, I think, the ultimate disaster book. And Denis Villeneuve, the director of Dune, it's been optioned as a movie that he's going to do. So... All right. Congratulations to Annie on that amazing book.
Indeed.
All right. One more break. And then the number one thing this week that made us go, wow.
You're listening to World of Wonders Wow Report. Things that make us go wow.
Welcome back to the Wow Report. Fenton here with Tom and James Blake. Been counting down the top 10 things that make us go wow. We've reached number one.
Number one.
I'm going to give a hint for people watching and listening.
Don Snorleone is what they say. Yes, Sleepy Don. Donald Trump was in court all week watching as his trial is getting underway. It's been something to watch. Have you guys been following the news?
Have to.
Interestingly, there was reports that as he was sleeping, he let out a large fart. But because, like, how do you report that on mainstream media? You don't. So that
wake himself up?
Yeah, he farted himself awake. Yes.
But isn't that the thing with him? Like earlier in the year, there was this whole thing that he's pooping in his pants all the time.
Yeah.
Like,
and what is going? Did they drug him up? Did they, you know, give him Xanax before, so he wouldn't have these outbursts?
He was just up all night watching Fox News.
Or was he up on Adderall all night? You know, what is the reason why he was so quiet and sleepy?
I think because he has to be quiet in a weird way. He's like, if you're an adrenaline junkie, he's like a rage junkie. And if he can't
apparently on Thursday, he was pulling his phone out and he was making threats to different potential jurors, and yet he's not being reprimanded or being
lying. I think the judge, I have a source inside the courtroom, they were saying that the judge actually is A, very strict in terms of adhering to the rules, and also very elegant and fair and personable and reasonable, and that actually the experience of being there is profoundly different from what is being reported, as I guess it would be. Like, if he wakes himself up from farting, that isn't going to make it on the nightly news, you know?
All right. So Blake wants us to end early, so let's just keep our voices down in case Donald's sleeping, listening. Donald, if you're listening, get your rest, honey.
I do wish there were cameras there, though, don't you?
Yeah. I thought the funniest thing was whenever they had to read the embarrassing things that all the potential jurors had said about him on their social media.
Yeah, he's
anyway, it's a moment in history that we needed to commemorate for a second.
Apparently the courtroom is not very prestigious in that it's a bit run down and the heating and cooling system is a bit wonky, and so it's apparently it's freezing in there, but if you adjust the thermostat, it suddenly becomes instantly broiling. So,
it's like Mar-a-Lago, he should be used to it.
Thanks for tuning in to the Wow Report on Radio Andy. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, James. Thank you, Blake. Same time, same place next week. Until then, go out and buy your copy of Screen Age. Do something that makes the world go
wow.